You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Tamara Tucker. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Sweely Holdings, LLC. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time for response. In the words of this Court, a demurrer tests only the legal sufficiency of a pleading, not matters of proof. The Court must accept as true the facts alleged and all reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the allegations. In this case, the trial court erred in three different ways when it sustained SunTrust demur. With regard to the fraud and constructive fraud counts, the trial court based its dismissal on two of the elements of fraud. First, the trial court found that there was no justifiable reliance as a matter of law by Sweely Holdings. And it did so based on the reasonings of this court in Metrocall and Murayama. However, we would submit that it extended the reasoning far beyond any logical extension.
How could there have been reasonable reliance on the bank's appraisals?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How could there have been, based upon the pled facts in the complaint and only based upon that, reasonable reliance as a matter of law?
The reasonable reliance is on the representation that by the bankers that they possessed appraisals that showed a negative equity cushion, that they had the appraisals. That's the reason for the unpublished opinion that was submitted in Bank of America versus
Trades. Why would a sophisticated business person in this kind of relationship accept that at face value? I mean, they've tried to market the property for a while. I don't see why they're in a different position to assess the independent value of the property. Why would there be this kind of reliance on that kind of statement?
It's the reliance on the fact that SunTrust said that they possessed appraisals that showed something.
But
they did not possess those appraisals.
But again, so what? Because that all goes to the value of the property and whether you're underwater, above water, whatever, vis-a-vis these loans, lines of credit, and so on. So, you know, a used car dealer says, well, it's worth $15,000, and I have a blue book back in the office that says that. Why would I say, well, I don't want to pay that, or I disagree, or whatever. Why is there that kind of reliance?
It's the same reasoning, and it's an identical argument that was made in that Bank of America's, the Wells Fargo case, or I mean a Bank of America case. And in that case, Bank of America's bankers were trying to work out a workout agreement, just like this one. They needed a loan modification. It was a troubled loan. And in that case, the banker said to the debtor, we have a document that shows a maturity date, and your loan is coming up on that maturity date.
Wasn't there evidence suggested in the complaint that your clients disputed these appraised values very directly?
My clients certainly believed their properties were worth more. That's beside the point.
So they're in dispute on the very thing that they say they reasonably relied upon.
They didn't rely on the value. They relied on the fact that SunTrust said, we have these appraisals, and we will go into bankruptcy court, and we will get out of bankruptcy court. We will get all of this collateral out. They did not have those appraisals. That's why it's so similar to the Bank of America case. In that case, that debtor knew for a fact that his loan didn't have a maturity date. But Bank of America kept saying, we've got a document that shows a maturity date. And he kept saying, show it to me, because I don't think there is one. And the appellate court sent that case back twice and said to the trial court, you have to believe that they believe, that the debtor believed that they possessed that document. Whether it had the maturity date or whether it didn't have the maturity date is entirely beside the point.
And an appraisal is a highly subjective thing, right? So a maturity date is, look, here's a loan. Right there, there's this clause that says here's a maturity date. And it's a fact. It either is or isn't. But an appraisal, I mean, you can find experts to talk about appraisals up and down, and that's what parties do. And if they're in this adversarial relationship where they're heading to bankruptcy or not and they're negotiating, isn't an appraisal different in its nature than just the fact of a maturity?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Not under these circumstances. I think the fact that they continuously represented, we have these documents, and stepping back a minute, I don't see this as an adversarial relationship at that point in time. It certainly became adversarial at a future point in time. But a forbearance agreement is an encouraged tool to get people to work out.
Well, but your client is contemplating bankruptcy. The bank's not excited about that. I mean, so it's not exactly like they're, you know, pulling on the same oar. I mean, there's at least some tension there. And maybe it's not Murayama. I mean, it is different from that. But at the same time, it's not a, you know, a friendly sort of thing.
That's the exact word I thought in my mind coming here today, was there's a tension, and their interests aren't completely aligned. But isn't that the case with almost every contract that you negotiate? Especially if you have counsel, there's each party's got things they want. Each party has things they don't necessarily want to give up. So to start extending Murayama into this, you know, field of, well, anytime you line up two lawyers and two people are talking about, well, I might do this or I could do that. And bankruptcy is simply protection. It's not really a threat. It's protection they could seek.
I'm not sure your thematic point is that helpful, because what you can see in all of these cases, at least from Virginia courts, is a pretty strong doctrinal line between contracts and torts. In every one of these cases, particularly with sophisticated business people, are pushing tort law because the contracts failed them, because they didn't negotiate the contracts favorably, and they want to get through tort law what they couldn't get through the negotiating process. That's the big doctrinal theme that you've got to overcome. You didn't overcome it with this trial court, and you're trying to overcome it here. How do you do that, particularly on the appraisals where they already contested the appraisals, and now they say, oh, we reasonably relied upon it, and they lied to us?
Well, they reasonably relied on the representation that they possessed those appraisals, and they did so until many years later in the course of this litigation when out come the appraisals. And frankly, it was a shock that they said what they said. No one thought that the appraisals were going to say something different. They believed that SunTrust had appraisals that said, you are underwater. Now, you're absolutely right. Was there a dispute about, we don't believe that that's the value of our property? Everybody thinks their property is worth more than that. But that's a different factor.
Why is that a different factor? Why isn't that the heart of it? That the whole point was, what is the property really worth? And both sides are claiming it's worth different numbers.
I would disagree. I think the whole point of it is, you're in a situation where you're trying to negotiate a workout agreement, a forbearance agreement, not a situation where you're negotiating a compromise settlement, which is different. And when someone says to you, I have this cudgel, essentially, I have this document, and I'm going to beat you over the head with it if you don't do what we want you to do.
Well, okay, but, I mean, why can't the other side say, well, I obviously don't buy that at all. I'm going to get my own expert. And the bankruptcy court, why does the bankruptcy court have to be persuaded by the bank versus anybody else?
Well, right? I think that's a fair point. I think that, you know, whether there was a question of, you know, could there have been other experts, whether there was a question whether there were other experts, may come out in the litigation. But at the demur stage, I don't think we're there yet. I think that's a big part of what went on in this case, is that I think assumptions were made by the trial court as to how this case would turn out. And that's not what we do on demur. There's a process, and it is our contention that the process was short-circuited. To your point, which I didn't answer, about overcoming the fraud in contract, this is a sequential problem. So to me, it's a little different than the traditional fraud contract dichotomy, because this is fraud in the inducement. And so either the agreement is voidable or it's not voidable. Then the breaches occur afterwards. So it's a sequence of wrongdoing, as far as I see. The tort came first, and then the breaches of contract come later. Will there be a point in time where damages overlap and you can't have a windfall? Of course.
It's a question of law as to whether any reasonable jury could determine reasonable reliance based upon the pled facts, right? But just abstractly, it's a question of law. So what is it about the pled facts that allowed a reasonable jury to say, you know, these sophisticated business people were duped and it was reasonable that they relied upon these particular statements about these particular appraisals in the context of a workout?
I think, number one, there's nothing in the complaint that shows the level of sophistication of this family business.
Well, they only had a debt that they were negotiating of $18.3 million, that's all.
Well, they had a lot of debt, but I don't know that debt necessarily indicates sophistication.
Well, but they're running a horse operation in one state, they're running a winery in another state. I mean, you're right, it could be they just inherited all of this or whatever, but I mean, it's at least suggestive of I mean, I don't know how to run a winery. I don't know anything about running a horse farm in the heart of horse country, you know, et cetera. So, I mean, that at least it doesn't bespeak of, you know, illiterate tenant farmer, you know, whatever, that kind of thing.
That's correct, Your Honor. I am into my reserve time, which I would like to reserve. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Walter Kirkman. I represent SunTrust Bank, Lindsay Rayum, and Lori Lee. The trial court's order sustaining the demur to Sweeley's lender liability claims in this case is supported by the express terms of the party's commercial loan workout agreement and by an on-point opinion of this court. We believe the Moriyama Trust case is on point for the factors that are set forth in that case and a Virginia statute that limits expert testimony. With respect to the breach of contract count, the Sweeley's result-oriented interpretation of the workout agreement ignores important non-waiver provisions and reads four sentences out of Section 5.5 of the agreement. Sweeley's brief refers prominently to this notion that Sweeley wanted to avoid the notoriety and negative business effect of foreclosures, so it negotiated a term that SunTrust wouldn't foreclose on collateral that was turned over on this timeline.
Could I interrupt you for a second?
Certainly.
Sweeley is focused very heavily in their argument today on fraud in the inducement. Can you address what the statements are specifically, what the allegations in the complaint are that render those statements not reasonably reliable?
Certainly, Your Honor. So the alleged misrepresentations are that SunTrust possessed appraisals showing that there was no equity in the four pieces of property that served as collateral for SunTrust loans. Now, the appraisals, as a matter of a motion craving lawyer, are incorporated in the complaint, so the appraised values are part of the joint appendix. And you can see that, actually, when you look at by property owner basis, there was, in fact, no equity in these properties. And when you look at the disposition values in the appraisals, and perhaps I'm venturing into a plea at bar that was never ruled on by the trial court, but when we look at the disposition values in the appraisals, there was in fact no equity. At the time that this alleged representation was made, SunTrust had appraisals that said the disposition values of your collateral is $13,500,000, which was way below the $17 million in debt. Now, we believe that the Moriyama Trust case is on point for reasonable reliance because of the four factors.
Those appraisals were all before the demur judge under craving order.
That's correct.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Certainly. We believe that Moriyama Trust is on point because of the four factors in that case where the court determined that if these factors are present, the party is going to be strictly held to the reasonable reliance standard. And we have those four factors here. We have represented parties. We have parties that were in an adversarial relationship. The Sweeley's tried to downplay that, but the fact of the matter is the loans had matured. SunTrust had sent out default notices. SunTrust had seized funds. Sweeley was concerned about the way that SunTrust was acting, but Sweeley felt that there was an interest reserve that could have allowed them another year and a half to work something out. And SunTrust was negotiating for a turnover of all the collateral. In the meantime, Sweeley's gone to bankruptcy counsel and is getting ready to file bankruptcy. Litigation was imminent. The whole premise of Sweeley's claim was that Sweeley was going to file bankruptcy but was tricked out of doing it because it believed that SunTrust had these appraisals that would have allowed SunTrust to obtain relief from the automatic stay in the bankruptcy case. So the parties entered into a fully integrated agreement with a mutual release, and it, by all accounts, it was to avoid litigation. Clearly, it wasn't the same facts as Moriyama Trust, but the factors are there. This was to avoid litigation. The parties described the release of the Sweely obligors, its Sweely Holdings and its family members and the affiliated entities as a full and final release. This was intended to be a full and final resolution of the parties' credit relationship. SunTrust wanted to either let Sweely have a chance to pay back the money that it owed or else sell its collateral in this 6 or 7 month time frame and move on. SunTrust didn't bargain for 4 more years of litigation afterwards. And I think that the issue with the appraisals also goes to the speculative nature of the damages that are alleged here. This amended complaint is based on the false notion that if Sweely filed bankruptcy, it could go down to the bankruptcy court, show the bankruptcy judge the appraisals that it was holding, and the court would enter an order terminating the automatic stay. It doesn't work that way, though. Sweely had the advice of competent bankruptcy counsel who would have advised Sweely that the standard for terminating the automatic stay is two-pronged. There's whether there's equity in the property, and that's looked at on a debtor-by-debtor basis, and whether the property is necessary for an effective reorganization. And that's Supreme Court law. It's a two-part test. There would be trial. You'd have to have a trial. There would be opposing evidence put on of the value of the properties and whether or not there was any equity. And there's just, as the trial court found, there's no way to prove that. A Chapter 11 motion for relief from stay is a very complex proceeding. And in fact, Sweely goes beyond that and alleges not only would we have gone into bankruptcy and been protected by the bankruptcy court, we would have reorganized in bankruptcy. That would require a whole other set of conclusions of law and findings of fact as to whether a proposed reorganization plan satisfies all the requirements of the bankruptcy code. So this notion that you can have a case within a case, which is recognized in Virginia law, and have the case within a case be a bankruptcy case, there's no authority for that cited in the appellant's brief. We didn't find any authority anywhere in any state or federal court. I think the reason for that is the unworkability, impracticability of having a state court conduct a complex Chapter 11. Those are involved processes that you just can't put a box around, and it's not a discrete legal issue like you would have in the normal case within a case. So it's the appellant's position that the finality of settlements would be undermined if after signing a settlement agreement, one of the parties was retrospectively permitted to unwind a comprehensive release based on the bare allegation that they would have filed bankruptcy or negotiated a better deal for themselves if they had known the weaknesses in the other side's negotiating position.
So your point there is for purposes of reasonable reliance and the standard the legal standard as to what threshold has to be crossed there. The very fact that you're in a negotiation and not making an agreement for commercial purposes, but making actually a release of prior claims.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's because it implicates the important policy reasons encouraging settlement, encouraging people to avoid foreclosures, encouraging people to stay out of bankruptcy and to come up with a business solution among themselves. That's why we believe that the Moriyama Trust should be extended to the workout agreement in this case. That's not to say that in all cases where a bank has a modification agreement or a workout agreement that you would apply strictly apply the reasonable reliance standard. Some of the cases cited in the appellant's brief talk about interim forbearance agreements where there's an arrearage on the loan. The borrower is given a few extra months to make up the arrearage. That's not what we have here. This was intended to be a full and final resolution of this credit relationship, and SunTrust just wanted to either get its money repaid, have its collateral sold, or have its collateral sold, and it wanted to walk away. And I think another, along those lines, another important point is if you look at what actually happened, SunTrust sold two pieces of its collateral, and then before the third piece was sold, it ended up selling the loan to a third party, and an affiliate of that third party made a deal with Sweely to convey the third parcel of collateral, which was the winery, in exchange for a release of all the promissory notes. So that left the fourth piece of collateral, the Acorn Hill Farm, unsold. And that's better than they would have done under the workout agreement. That's better than they would have done under the original loan documents. So the notion that they could have negotiated an even better deal for themselves is just speculative. And I wanted to just go back to the first assignment of error very quickly, because there's one point that I wanted to underscore from our brief, and that is that our position is that there were no recognizable damages from the breach of contract alleged. And when you look at the transcript of the trial court's ruling on page 90, the trial court sustained the demur to the breach of contract count on the basis that, or on the basis of the arguments of the defense. And then when you look on the trial transcript, which is page 91 of the joint appendix, where the trial court rules on the count 6, which is a business expectancy count, the court again recognized this problem with damages. And when you look at the amended complaint at paragraph 152, which is the breach of contract count, and then 161, which is the tortious interference with business expectancy count at 161, they allege the exact same damages, which was that Sweely was in negotiations with third parties for an equity investment or a sale or whatever. And the trial court found that that wasn't probable. So, again, even with the breach of contract count, you have trial court finding that damages were speculative and not legally recognized. So Sweely readily accepted the benefit.
But wouldn't, I know it might be a really steep hill to climb, but supposing they could bring in one of these investors or somebody else to say, oh, well, but for all this stuff, I would have paid a lot more and so on. I mean, I understand that would be a tough sell, but it's one thing at the conclusion of trial to say, look, you just didn't meet your burden. It's another thing at demur to say, yeah, your damages theory is pretty darn thin, but I'm going to, just dismiss it at this stage.
Well, Your Honor, the count 6 is not a subject of any assignment of error.
No, I understand that, but you're sort of bringing that back into some of these other counts, right, if I understand your argument.
That's correct. But what the court found for count 6, and I think what the court found on the first complaint that was that the demur was sustained to, and it's not the subject of this appeal, is that there were no damages from the breach. The second amended complaint, and the reason being is that what was alleged was essentially reputation damage, and it was just too speculative. There was no probability that any of these deals would be made with any of these third parties. Okay.
I thought the point of count one in the court's holding was that the judge read the contract and said, no, you can accept title or foreclose. It just says you can do either one. You don't have any obligation to do one or the other.
That's correct, Your
Honor. There were no proffers of two of the Madison County properties, which would be required for the accepting title. Wasn't that the holding?
That was the primary holding.
Well, that's probably what you should talk about.
Well certainly in those few moments that I have left, that holding was based on the read of the parties' express agreement that says in section 5.5 the specific timeline for liquidating the collateral, that immediately after the turnover date, that SunTrust can foreclose on collateral that's turned over. And if you adopt Sweely's interpretation of the agreement, which is a result-oriented interpretation based on allegations that aren't in the amended complaint but were a vestige of the original complaint. What you have is you read those sentences completely out of Section 5.5, because if SunTrust could only foreclose after a forbearance default, there was no reason to put those sentences in about foreclosing after a turnover date, because once there's a forbearance default, all bets are off. SunTrust can foreclose on all of its collateral and can pursue its rights and remedies under the loan documents. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Ms. Tucker?
I'll work backwards. I'll start with the contract issue. First of all, the trial court did not base its ruling on damages on the contract count the second time around. It did the first time around. The ruling was different the second time around. What's important, both for the contract claim and the fraud claim, is to recognize that the forbearance agreement was finite in nature. It was not a full and final settlement. It had an end date, June 30th, 2011. So at the end of the forbearance period, if there hadn't been a forbearance default, and if Sweely Holdings still somehow owed money, the remedies from the original loan contracts kicked in. This is not a full and final resolution. And why that's important is that for the contract claim, it makes the language that has been read out of the agreement by the court, the can only commence after a forbearance default, it makes perfect sense. Because this is what you have. You have an agreement where you either pay us by this date or turn over a property. You pay us by this date, turn over a property, and on it goes until June 30th, 2011. Sweely Holdings alleges, we didn't want foreclosure advertisements. We're trying to raise capital, which is required under the forbearance agreement, and you're undercutting us by foreclosing. We don't want that.
But didn't the contractual language give them the option to do foreclosure?
It does not. It gives them the option to do foreclosure if there's a forbearance default, which is defined as various things, and it gives them the option to do it after the forbearance period. So on June 30th, 2011, when the last property, had it been turned over, on June 30th, 2011, had the notes not been sold to a third party, what could have happened is that they could have done a foreclosure sale at that point in time, which makes perfect sense.
What's the turnover date, for example, for the winery? Is that the March 31st date?
Yes, March 31st.
So what does the language mean that counsel read immediately after such SunTrust may, immediately after such turnover date, schedule and conduct a foreclosure sale?
It means they can schedule and conduct a foreclosure sale subject to the provisions of 8.12. Which is where the limiting language comes in. Now, if there's been a forbearance default along the way, go for it. Have a foreclosure sale at that point in time. If the forbearance period is over, June 30th, 2011.
Does 8.12 contemplate two potential instances of foreclosure, one after the forbearance default and one independent?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
Does 8.12 contemplate two opportunities to foreclose? One normal foreclosure, you haven't paid your debt, I'm going to foreclose on you, and then the other after the forbearance default date. Does it give SunTrust the option? I can wait for a forbearance default, or I can foreclose as I normally would.
No, it does not. What the agreement as a whole says, including 8.12, is if there's no forbearance default during this forbearance period of time, while we're working this out, you cannot use the foreclosure mechanism. You take the property by deed. That makes perfect sense with all of the allegations that are alleged. This is an unusual set, at least in my cases, where I have so much information that I can allege about what the parties actually thought they were doing. And the SunTrust bankers repeatedly said in emails, this is a property or proceeds conveyance. We're taking the properties by deed in lieu. They drafted a deed in lieu, sent it to a lawyer in Virginia who said, you don't really want to do that. You're safer foreclosing. That's when it switched to the foreclosure, and they wanted to foreclose. Up until that point in time, there was no dispute that these properties were to be turned over by deed in lieu, and that's because it was negotiated, and the fact is alleged in the complaint as to when that term was even reached, the date on which that term was reached. So I would say, in answer to your question, no. They can only foreclose when there's a forbearance default during the forbearance period. After that, all bets are off. And there's a possible scenarios where the properties are still in transit or money is still owed. Despite the fact that everybody did want the relationship wrapped up by June 30th, 2011, there was no guarantee that it would be. And that's what makes this not a settlement agreement. If it was a settlement agreement, you would have a full and final resolution, and if a party breached it, you would sue on the settlement agreement.
So there's no meaning to the heading, friendly foreclosure of real property collateral upon expiration of a property-specific deadline or forbearance default.
There is no meaning to that heading per the terms of the contract and under Virginia law.
And then the wording of the paragraph that seems to track that heading, one talking about an additional inducement, foreclosure, the other having the strange parenthetical, but only after forbearance default, friendly foreclosure. What's the meaning of the parenthetical?
The meaning of the parenthetical is what we say is the meaning of the contract. And we say it was specifically inserted on a certain date after negotiations. Was it artfully drafted? No. It was not artfully drafted. This looks like boilerplate language that has a specific term that the parties negotiated shoved in, and to the extent that it's ambiguous, the trial court should have heard evidence at later on in the litigation process as to what the parties intended.
So your position is this entire contract relates to a forbearance default trigger?
For the purposes of using the foreclosure mechanism.
Correct.
Yes.
And for some odd reason, in the event of a foreclosure action, in the event of foreclosure action is commenced, and then there is this strange parenthetical that just reiterates what the whole contract is about, that's how we should read 812?
I would say that that parenthetical gives the meaning to the contract. That parenthetical is the key term in the contract, the key negotiated term in the contract. And the fact that it appears in parentheses is beside the point. It's language that needs to be given meaning.
With the Chief's permission, may I follow up with one brief question?
Yeah.
Is it your position that the contractual language that Justice Powell just related to you is ambiguous and thus parole evidence needed to be presented? And if that were your position today, did you argue that in the trial court?
We did in briefing, Your Honor. During the actual hearing, we didn't hear argument, if I recall correctly. We didn't get to the contract. The contract claims always seem to sort of get left behind. But yes, it is our position that, and it has been our position all along, that the language is explicit, and to the extent it's ambiguous, it requires parole evidence.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. The court is adjourned.